All right, it's time for us to get started. We're on outline, lesson number 19 in Acts chapter 25. Spend here a couple minutes kind of reviewing. You've had a two-week break from me. That must be refreshing. Glad you all are here tonight. Would you pray with me? Our Father, we're so very grateful for the beautiful day that we've enjoyed. Thankful for so many good blessings that you give us day by day. And we give thanks, Father, for the time we have now to come and to study and pray that you help our minds to be open and refreshed. Help us to think carefully about your will and what you have to say to us. Help us to understand it. Help us to live it in our lives. We are so thankful that you bless us so richly. You care for us and our needs day by day. And pray that you continue to bless us. And we ask especially that you will bless us in faith, encourage us, help us always to be your own people, and forgive our sins. In Jesus' name, amen. So in our last lessons, as we're kind of getting close to the end now of the missionary journeys of Paul, he's been imprisoned in Caesarea now for 2 years. And Felix has pretty well kept him there. You know, the corrupt character of Felix, I think, kind of comes out in that period of time. Felix really could have let him go, you know, long before, but was holding on to him. Not that he found any guilt in Paul, but presumably to appease the Jews, one thing, and probably hoping that Paul at some point would get tired of waiting and just give him some money, bribe him to get out. But that wasn't going to happen. So he continued to hold Paul for all of this time. But at this point in this story, Felix leaves the story. I mean, he's taken away from Caesarea. He has some other problems to contend with, and he is sent off to Rome. So he's replaced by Festus. And so Festus is the one that comes in and now has to deal with some of the things that Felix had left. Paul's only one thing that he had to deal with. There were some other issues that he had to deal with. There was a lot of ill will that had been generated by Felix in the time that he was the procurator in that region, in that area. And the situation between the Jews and Rome is increasingly getting bad. In fact, over just the next few years, it's going to get to a catastrophic point until Jerusalem is no more. I mean, so we're not that far away at this point from the destruction of Jerusalem that takes place in 70 AD. So when Festus comes into town, it's somewhere around 59 or 60 AD is our time frame. And so now we can sort of put a clock on some events that are going to be taking place that lead up to the 70 AD time and the destruction of Jerusalem. Well, Felix had made a reputation for himself of being a very cruel and corrupt leader. As we said, there was this growing animosity that was taking place between him and the Jews. And in fact, that's one reason why he's called to Rome to deal with some charges of misconduct. And so as this animosity continues to grow, the rebelliousness of the Jews is what really starts to stand out. I'm not saying that they weren't rebellious before Felix. We already know there was attitude problems among the Jews before that time, but it almost seems as though he kind of fostered some ill will that just continued to grow worse. And so Festus, when he arrived in Caesarea, spent little time, but directly turned and went to Jerusalem. Let's go back in our text in chapter 25 and read the first few verses there as we kind of ramp back up. Now when Festus had come to the province, after 3 days he went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Then the high priest and the chief men of the Jews informed him against Paul, and they petitioned him, asking a favor against him, that he would summon him to Jerusalem while they lie in ambush along the road to kill him. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept in Caesarea and that he himself was going there shortly. Therefore he said, let those who have authority among you go down with me and accuse this man to see if there is any fault in him. And so we recall that, again, the Jews were saying, we just want to kill him. I mean, that was their plan. And so they thought perhaps with Festus, he would say, all right, we can work this out. We'll be traveling through with Paul night after tomorrow night, and you know, he's yours. No, I don't know that Festus was the most honorable man, but he saw some problems with this. And whether it was just simply trying to save Paul's life or that he had some regard for the law, well, I'm not sure exactly. You know, but of course, if he had allowed something like that to happen and it made its way back to Rome, that likely would not have worked good for him. Because Paul has already declared himself to be a Roman citizen and the law protects him. That is, that he has the right to defend himself before his accusers. And so Festus understood that. And so he was not going to allow this situation to go on, but instead turned it around to the Jews. Well, you choose among yourselves your leaders, and you send them to Caesarea to accuse the man, to accuse Paul. And so it's there about where we left off in the lesson the last time. And so when we look at verse 6 and following here, is Festus questioning Paul back in Caesarea? Let's read verse 6. And when he had remained among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. And the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, he commanded Paul to be brought. And when he had come, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood about and laid many serious complaints against Paul, which they could not prove, while he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I offended in anything at all. But Festus, wanting to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and there be judged before me concerning these things? And Paul said, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know. For if I am an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if there is nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, no one can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar. Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, you have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you should go. So when Festus had gone to Jerusalem, it wasn't a rush trip. He stayed 10 more days after the Jews at first made their request of him before he went back to Caesarea. But soon after going back to Caesarea, he deals with the issue. And that is, Paul is brought to his judgment seat. And he hears some things from Paul. And so, the complaints, the accusations of those Jewish leaders were not accusations that could be proved. And very quickly, Festus was able to see that. And in Paul's response in return to him, it's not against the law that I have sinned, nor against the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar. You know, complaints have been made, but where's the proof is what he is saying. And so think for a moment here. What was the question that Festus had of Paul? What did he ask Paul?
He's willing to go to Jerusalem.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you willing to go to Jerusalem? Then again, how did he respond to that? No. Why should I go? I mean, that's more or less what he was saying. Yeah, I'm not afraid of death. I'm not refusing to die if I've done wrong. But my defense has already been made 2 years ago. You're hearing my defense again. Why would I go to Jerusalem? And can you imagine if Paul had gone to Jerusalem? What would that scene have been like? I mean, what if he was protected? Which, if he was going back to Jerusalem actually for a real trial, the Roman soldiers would have to protect him getting there just like they did when he left Jerusalem. So suppose he's taken back to Jerusalem. How do you suppose that's going to go? It's going to be against Paul. What's going to happen in town, do you suppose? Everyone's going to be glad to see Paul?
That 40.
No.
Those 40 men are still hungry, aren't they?
Yeah, the 40 men 2 years ago, you know, who had taken a vow that they would not eat until they killed Paul. I mean, they're real thin right now. It's true. He would never made it to Jerusalem.
He was supposed to go to Rome.
But if he had been taken to Rome somehow, I can only imagine what turmoil that would have caused. That would have been a mess. But of course, the Lord has a bigger plan in this because Paul, in fact, is going to Rome. And so we soon see that. It's interesting to me that even now, 2 years later, the Jewish leaders haven't come up with a better plan. You know, it's like they've already proven themselves to be dishonest. I'm surprised they haven't come up with false accusers at this point or something. So they've come and they've made the same accusations and offer no proof. You would think that they would have bought some proof by now, but that hasn't happened. So Paul appeals to Caesar. What exactly does that mean? What does that entail? Why did he appeal to Caesar?
He's a Roman citizen.
He has the right.
Kind of like the Supreme Court. And he's just going up the chain. No one else is being able to make a judgment about what's going on here. So.
Right. Right.
Caesar is the final authority.
Yes.
In everything.
Yeah.
So if you appeal to him, there's nothing higher.
Something's going to happen there. You know, so yeah, it's like the Supreme Court, like Rick said. That's the top level. And he has the right to do this because he is a Roman citizen. You know, in some ways, I wonder about Festus. He says he's appealed to Caesar, he'll go to Caesar. If he hadn't appealed to Caesar, I wonder if Festus would have made a judgment. Well, I don't know. I don't know where he would have or not. I mean, would he have done like Felix? You know, and kind of backed up from it. Because if Festus had made a judgment, the Jews wouldn't have been happy about it at all if Festus was in fact honest about it. So it's kind of an interesting story when you think about the depth of some of these things as they were happening. So the appealing to Caesar very likely preserved Paul's life. If he had been freed from prison, or if he had gone to Jerusalem, he would have been killed. Yeah, it's like, what if he had just been, if Festus had said, there's no basis to these charges, Paul, you're a free man. I wonder how long he would have been free before he was a dead man. You wonder about how that would go. So Festus sought help from Agrippa. So we have a new character that's coming into our story now. Agrippa. And we ask the question, who is Agrippa? Let's read just a little bit. We're beginning at verse 13. And after some days, King Agrippa and Bernice came to Caesarea to greet Festus. And when they had been there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there is a certain man left a prisoner by Felix, about whom the chief priest and the elders of the Jews informed me when I was in Jerusalem, asking for a judgment against him. To them I answered, it is not the custom of the Romans to deliver any man to die before he who is accused meets the accusers face to face and has opportunity to answer for himself concerning the charge laid against him. Therefore, when they had come together without any delay, the next day I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought in. When the accuser stood up, they brought no accusation against him of such things as I supposed, but had some questions against him about their own religion and about one Jesus, who was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. And because I was uncertain of such questions, I asked him whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and be judged concerning these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be reserved, for the decision of Augustus, I commanded him to be kept until I could send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, "I also would like to hear the man myself." "Tomorrow," he said, "you shall hear him." Well, let's stop there for a minute. Did that come back up, Rick? Or again? Came back up? Okay. So now that we're trying to get this next picture here kind of in our mind, it must have gone back to the beginning, did it? I think it did. Look for it. I don't know where it went now. Okay. Think about the scene now as it's unfolding and what's happening in Caesarea. So Agrippa comes into the story. So the first question is, who is Agrippa? And what's he doing in Caesarea? Why is Festus asking any questions of Agrippa? Well, why is Agrippa sitting on the judgment seat now? And back to the first question, who is he? Do you know anything about Agrippa? And this takes a little study to do. He is the son of Herod Agrippa I, who's the grandson, who is the son of Herod the Great. There's kind of a line here of Herods that we deal with in the New Testament time. So this is Herod Agrippa II, and officially named Marcus Julius Agrippa, usually just called Agrippa. There's a picture of him up there, a bust made of him, and some pictures on the coins that were minted during part of his reign. It was about 2 years, 53-54 AD, when these coins were minted. Coins that were not appreciated by the Jews too much because they bore some images contrary to some things that the Jews believed or agreed with. So already understand that there's some animosity between the Jews and Agrippa. And so there's that going on in the backstory. Agrippa is the great-grandson of Herod the Great. Not Herod number one, I have up. That's incorrect. Herod the Great. So there's an interesting lineage here that you find in the first century with some of these Herods that we read about and Agrippas. There's two Agrippas. This is the second one. And so, you know, there's a dynasty of Herods. Now, if I say there's a dynasty, what comes to your mind? What is that supposed to mean? But of these rulers of the first century, there was a dynasty.
Family.
There's a family of rulers. You know, remember that in the Roman Empire, Palestine is just a very small piece of that. And so there are kings, you know, throughout, I think it's 57 provinces or places of rule that the Roman Empire is ruling over. There's a lot of kings. And sometimes the word king is used in what we might think of a light way, you know, because if there's 57 provinces, we might think there's 57 kings. No, there's probably a lot more than that. Because someone might be given the title of king who is actually just over a small area within such as the area of Palestine. And you multiply that by all the other provinces, if you will, of Rome. There was a lot of leadership. But there were some who bore greater responsibility and maybe was a king over the greater part of a region who responded and answered directly back to Rome. You know, if you are a direct report to Rome, the emperor knows your name. That can be a good thing. Well, it can be a bad thing, too. It depends how he knows your name. And so it seems as though even though this problem that Festus is dealing with is not exactly a direct report kind of a situation for Agrippa, he doesn't want any problems in that region, because actually the region that he has responsibility for is just a little bit north of here. And it's interesting to me that Agrippa is here sitting on the judgment seat. But he doesn't want these problems with the Jews going on. The problems with the Jews is something that continues to escalate and is already something that Rome is well aware of. And that has an effect throughout the whole region. And Agrippa, this is Agrippa II, knows something about the Jews because there's a lot of Jews in the region where he's responsible. And in fact, at this point in time, even though Jerusalem is not in the center of his district, so to speak, he does have responsibility in Jerusalem. I don't quite understand that, because he doesn't have full responsibility in the area around Jerusalem. Some others do in Judea. But he is the one who's been given responsibility in Jerusalem and even has been given some authority by Rome to appoint the high priests in Jerusalem. Now, that's not part of Jewish law. That's not how high priests were to be chosen. But that was part of the Roman law at this point. And so we're getting a little bit of a picture, maybe, of who Agrippa is, what some of his responsibility is, and there's this big problem among the Jews, and Festus is saying, you know, I don't know how to deal with this. Do you have any advice? And Agrippa says, I'll take care of this. I'll sit on the judgment seat. But then you have to ask a little bit as to what would he know about the situation, Agrippa, and why would he sit on that judgment seat? Well, let's back up for just a minute here. Let's think about this just a little bit further. You know, there's quite a family connection of rulers in this region that Agrippa would be kin to. We're talking about the dynasty. You know, we should understand something about dynasties. In our own country, we've had political dynasties. The Kennedys has been going on for 60 years or more. Now, it'll be a lot more than that when you consider Granddaddy Kennedy. There's a political dynasty that continues to go on to this day. I mean, we understand something about that. And that's kind of how it was with many of those that were titled Herod, like from the lineage of Herod the Great. That's really where that dynasty started, back, you know, before Christ in the B.C. Era. You know, there was the Herod the Great, the one who, I wanted to say built Jerusalem. That wouldn't be right. Jerusalem was there. But he refashioned Jerusalem. It was Herod the Great who went into Jerusalem and increased the size of the city and increased the walls built around the city. It was Herod the Great that built the temple in Jerusalem, or rebuilt the temple. And so he had made his mark on Jerusalem. It was Herod the Great that built the city of Caesarea, where Paul is at right now on trial. Remember, you know, it was 22 to 10 B.C. that he built the city, the great city of Caesarea, and the theater and the hippodrome and the harbor, and his palace was there. And his influence throughout that region it continues through the years. Well, he died in 4 B.C. He was a powerful leader throughout that whole area, throughout that region. In fact, if we look at a map, it's a little bit hard to see on here. But if you look at this map right here and you think about Herod the Great, if you look at this whole region with the dark outline around here, that's all part of the region of Herod the Great. That's his kingdom. Well, when he dies in 4 BC, he has some sons who have come along the way. Not one of them becomes the king of that whole region. But instead, it's broke up between three of his sons. So you see the different colors here, and this yellow area here, and this area here and there, and this over here. Philip and Antipas and Archelaus, three of his sons, who become, well, they're called Herod. They each carry that title, but they don't have the same rank that their father did in Rome. In fact, their leadership is, in some cases, was just not nearly as strong, nearly as good. It was Agrippa I who ruled the full kingdom. It did go back to when another generation came along. The Agrippa we're talking about today, Agrippa II, when his father came along, he ruled in such a way where he basically ruled that full kingdom there again. He was in greater favor in Rome, or perhaps had demonstrated an ability to lead in a stronger way. And if we look here a little bit, I hope you know this is probably pretty hard to see, isn't it? You have to look real careful. But if we look at this, if we look at Herod the Great, he ruled over the southern area, Samaria, Judea, over the northern area of Galilee, and the northeastern area too. He ruled over all of those areas. But when his sons came along, Archelaus, Antipas, and Philip, those areas were kind of broken up. And each of those three Herods are mentioned in the New Testament. Not always exactly by name, but they're all part of the Gospels. I mean, if you think about this Herod right here, this is the Herod that called for the death of all male children in Matthew chapter 2. And it's why Joseph and Mary had to leave Palestine and they went to Egypt. Remember? That was one of the sons of Herod. And then Antipas, this is the Herod that took Philip's wife. Remember that? And the one also who beheaded John the Baptist. And then there was Philip over here as well. Just looking at the dynasty and how this kind of rolls along, so we understand who we're talking about when we talk about Herod Agrippa the II. When Agrippa the II's father came along, 39 AD, you know, he started, 37 AD, he started ruling over the northeastern provinces up there. And then in 39 AD, he started reigning as well around Galilee. And then a little bit later, he picked up the whole southern region too. So now he had that whole area that Herod the Great had one time ruled. But then when he dies and he is no more, the Roman governors basically took over. In fact, at that point in time, Rome left no kingship in that area, but put in their own governors to rule. And it was that way for a period of time, for about 10 years or so. Because now when Agrippa the I died, Agrippa the II, whom we are talking about in our lesson today, you know, he was still kind of a young man and was not sent to rule in his father's place. I wonder a little bit if there was some other reasons that maybe we don't know about. But it wasn't like he was a child, but he was a little bit of a younger man. And the emperor, Claudius Caesar, returned all that whole region there of Judea to the status of a province. But while Agrippa II was still there in Rome, he was schooled and he was educated well, and he was put with some responsibility in the court systems there, and he learned how to be a lawyer, I guess you would say. He learned the law real well. He learned some things about the Jewish nation too. Of course, he would have grown up knowing some things about the Jewish nation because that's where he lived. That's where he grew up. And his father had to deal with matters of Jewish law, so he knew something about that. Some have said that he took an interesting perspective to Rome when he went there and some of the things that he dealt with, but he certainly learned how to deal with judgments, how judgments were made. He learned something about how lawyers would talk in the courtroom, and he learned about the way and the means of speech that was full of flattering phrases, as sometimes lawyers can use. All of this comes back to serve him well. Well, it would have served him more well if his heart had been just a little bit better. But But when he came back and he was given the rule in parts and places of Palestine, he knew something about Jewish law, he knew something about the Roman law, and he knew something about making judgments. That's how he had been trained. And so it's not a surprise to me that Festus says to him, "I don't know what to do about this." And it seems that Agrippa II immediately says, "I will hear him." And he is willing the next day to sit on the judgment seat and to hear Paul. He was well positioned to be in that place and to be there and ready to do that. So Agrippa II, his rule and his reign continued to kind of grow. It was north in the northern districts is where his responsibility was, but in time he picked up more, or I guess you would say he was awarded more territory in Galilee and Perea, and he had proven himself something what to be of some kind of a leader, and perhaps that is why he received the authority over the temple in Jerusalem. So we mentioned that a few minutes ago. See, his rule was not actually down in Judea, but he knew something about Jewish law, and maybe that's why he was given the responsibility in Jerusalem. And since this problem came out of Jerusalem, it's setting in Caesarea right now, but the problem came out of Jerusalem. Maybe that's why Festus said to him, "Will you, can you hear this matter?" And why he readily took that on. Tell me, what would be another reason or two that you can think of why Agrippa would be willing to hear this matter, and why Festus wants to get it done and put away with? Why?
You think Agrippa would overrule Festus?
Since it's already been determined, Festus had said, "You appeal to Caesar you will go." I don't think that he would back up on that unless there was something that was just so obvious that it goes to Caesar and Caesar goes like, "Why was this sent to me?" Yeah, good point. Yeah, by this point in time, 54 AD, the Caesar now is Nero. He's a real nice guy. Not hardly. Okay, and this is interesting too. The idea that Paul is appealing to Nero. What do we know about Nero? Yeah, burn Rome. Blame the Christians. What was Nero doing around this point in time in Rome with Christians? Burning them. Burning them on stakes to light the city streets. There's a part of me when I think about that, it's kind of like, Paul, what are you thinking? I mean, why would you want to go to Nero? Why would you want to go to Rome? Well, I'm sure he has his reasons in this. But isn't that sort of ironic when you think about all of that? You see, there's a whole lot of backstory going on in this period of time. The events that are unfolding. Some of it we can understand, and I'm sure there's a lot of it we don't understand. But it is just interesting to know something about the backstory. And it gives us maybe a little fuller view of what's happening. Neil and Dave.
You said this was about 2 years before the fall of Jerusalem.
No, we're about 10 years before the fall of Jerusalem. We're around 59 or 60 AD right now.
I'm wondering if there was some discussion in the higher ranks, these people being a problem. And perhaps he was trying to gain more insight on Jewish attitude, mentality as far as
yes.
How they were.
Okay, I think that is part of the story. Okay, if we back up for just a minute to Felix again. One of the reasons Felix now has been summoned to Rome is because of the problems and difficulties among the Jews. You know, remember we talked some before, you know, about when Paul was still in Jerusalem and there was some, you know, riots kind of going on when Paul was there, and it seemed like the commander of the guard was trying to get this quieted down and everything. Remember we talked about that a little bit, you know, and why he would be so interested in doing that. You know, he doesn't want to be the commander of an insurrection in Jerusalem. I mean, there was already word back to Rome at this point that, man, there's a lot of problems going on in Jerusalem. And in fact, the attitude of the Jews from this point, and even from before now, but particularly from this point going forward, the attitude of the Jews continues to grow worse. Now, some have said, going back to Felix again, that Felix did a lot of things that kind of brought that about in the 6 years of his reign there. His relationship with the Jews was less than good. There were some times it would seem that he did some things to kind of, you know, quell the uprisings. But I get the impression very much that he's just trying to save his own skin. You know, because he wasn't particularly kind to the Jews, but if things just got way out of hand, he would do some things to kind of calm things down enough, just enough to kind of patch it and keep things going. He didn't want it to get back to Rome, because that could be a problem. Well, it became a problem for him. That's why he's back to Rome now.
When you look at secular history during this time, you know, once we go through Christ's crucifixion with Pontius Pilate. Mm-hmm. Pontius Pilate kind of drops out of the picture, mm-hmm. and we don't have anything else in the scriptures that tells us what happened to him. What happens to Pontius Pilate, though, is he shortly thereafter, Christ's crucifixion, gets sent to a very remote Roman outpost mm-hmm. in the mountains of Switzerland, what presently Switzerland. Right,
because he did such a good job.
And he stayed there until his health faded to the point mm-hmm. where he went back to Rome and died.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, he was banished to the...
It was not a promotion.
Outpost, okay? These guys knew that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm sure it's well understood among these rulers. What happens when you do a good job? The benefits that come from that. They also know what happens if the emperor is not satisfied with what you do. So I mean, I'm not sure what it was like in all of the other provinces of the Roman Empire. I'm sure there's some similar kind of stories and political games that go on. We're only, in the scripture, we're only being introduced to what happens in Palestine. You know, and boy, it's like a soap opera, isn't it? I mean, the story that's going on. And so, yeah, to a great degree, these rulers are trying to save their own skin. They're trying to do things right in such a way where they're looked at well by Rome, and they are moved to a better province, and they're afforded more riches and things such as that. So Agrippa II, you know, he has the responsibility of Jerusalem, or the temple at least, and has responsibility here among the Jews. And so he wants to take care of some of these problems. He's trying to fix some of the problems that Felix has left behind, because there's a tremendous amount of ill will that's already been built up. I suppose that's one reason why Agrippa went to Jerusalem in his first days and spent 10 days there. He's trying to get to know the leaders. He's trying to say, hey, can't we get along? You know, can't we make things better here? You know, let's all be nice and get along. And immediately he's faced with, you know, Paul up there in Caesarea, we want to kill him. And so Festus is trying to, or Agrippa is trying to figure out how do we deal with this and still abide by the law. That's the dilemma that he's facing. And so when Festus says to Agrippa, you know, will you hear his defense? You know, and he agrees to do it and sits on the judgment seat. He's hoping, maybe against hope, that this can easily be resolved and he can put a stamp on it and say, we don't have to send this to Caesar. When everybody's happy now, okay, this is resolved. One last thing Caesar has to hear about from our region. But it doesn't work that way. That's not where that is left. Okay, so we got ahead of ourselves a little bit. Agrippa actually hasn't come in to make that judgment yet, but we understand something about his area of rule and his reign, his authority over temple matters. We know that's interesting to me too. We mentioned this, but like, it was Agrippa who appointed the high priests. Like, where did that come from? That's not part of the law. But now he is appointing the high priests. How do you suppose that goes over? I mean, in Jerusalem, among the Jews. How does that go over that Agrippa is appointing their high priests?
Well, there could be resentment.
There could be resentment by everyone? This is kind of a catch-22. Yeah, probably not for a high priest. That's right. And those who support that particular high priest. It's a real catch-22. Because we've already seen just how great the animosity has grown between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Where's the high priest going to come from? Most likely from one of those two sects of the Jews. And so if you pick a high priest that's a Sadducee, well, the Pharisees are all mad at you now, and vice versa. Does that sound familiar or what? I mean, it's very much like that today, I'm afraid. But that shouldn't have been happening anyway. But now we're understanding perhaps something about just what the situation had become in Jerusalem. And Rome's view of the Jews in Jerusalem. I don't know exactly when that started taking place or what was the circumstances that brought it around. And I don't want to stretch too far on this, but I'm just thinking, I kind of presume that there was enough problems in there that someone in Rome said, all right, Agrippa, go down there. Just, you know, choose somebody to lead those Jews that can work some of this out. Well, who should I? I don't care. Just fix it. And so he was given authority over the temple. Now, he's the one that's supposed to choose the ruler that's going to help, you know, fix some of those problems. I can only presume that was some of the reasoning behind that. Agrippa's not in a great position in my mind. I would have been happy with that little outpost in Switzerland, Gary. You know, it seems like not a lot would happen there. And so here's the thing I want to leave us with. That over the next 10 years, I mean, we haven't finished talking about Paul yet, but just for a moment, just think that over the next 10 years, the situation in Jerusalem is not going to get any better, but is only going to get worse with greater insurrection and riots and problems. That certainly is going to make its way to Rome, to the point that Rome says, all right. And the emperor says to his son, says to Vespasian, go fix it. Just go down there and fix it. How did he fix it? And when Titus walked, put on the siege and came into Jerusalem, how did he quiet the Jews? The blood was running in the streets. It was the end of the Jewish nation. Rome had enough. And so we're not there yet. In fact, that's not even a part of the missionary journeys of Paul. But it has something to do with the events that are taking place now. It's part of the story of sort of the end result of some things that are happening in Jerusalem and in Caesarea right now. That's where that's going to be going. Okay, on our outline, the next question we're looking is, describe the atmosphere of this meeting when Agrippa comes. Chapter 25, verse 13, if you mark that, It's somewhere right in there. Boy, how do we get started back in this on Sunday? This is where we're coming from and where we're trying to go. Thank you for being here tonight.